September 10th, 2020. So Bob Woodward called me today, said he wanted to do 18 interviews with me. 18 interviews. Even I don't have the time or the ego for that. Today's guest is local boy done great KMOV, Steve Savard. He didn't owe me a favor. We're not in a sweeps week. He just took an unsolicited call and agreed to be part of what we got going on here on OT. Councilman Sam Page just turned the faucet off on St. Louis County Athletics, and a lot of folks are getting pretty thirsty. No volleyball games for my 8th grader. All right, check this. You know the only group that is 100% wearing masks? 8th graders, when they are told if you don't, you go home and virtual learn. Seems to me there are other areas, Sam, you could be sticking your nose in. NFL exhibitions start this week. Let the experiment begin. 3 things you should if you have not. Get a funky, personalized mask to wear. Change it up a little bit. Have some fun. It's like getting a cool new jacket. Just makes you feel better. Number 2, have a taco night. It's not expensive. You can please anyone at the table. All hands on deck, prepping together, catching up on your day. Vegetarian, carnivore, everybody wins. Kicking carbs, make it a salad. Throw in something you might not usually try. Sour cream fixes everything. The world is your oyster. Although if fish taco is what you want, I'd recommend something else. Okay, I learned this week that what this podcast needs is more reviews and recommendations. If you would be so kind, that'd be great. Get St. Louis Conversation in front of more ears. If you hit the subscribe button, I'll also leave you one present every Monday and Thursday, updating you on new episodes. Feel free to check out Steve St. Louis 7 on YouTube. Steve talks about life without the Rams and answers 6 other St. Louis questions. Past episodes with Art Holiday, Ray Hartman, and others are also up on YouTube for your viewing pleasure. All right, number 3. Hey, watch Steve and the Gang on Channel 4. If you're privy to another channel, no sweat. Tape Channel 4. Check it out for a week. It's a well-balanced 30 minutes. Still watch your favorite. We've got time to do both. Now on to Steve. Audio in this podcast is not perfect. Zoom has its issues, but the quality of the content is strong. Here's what is undeniable about Steve. He loves what he does, and he cares about St. Louis. The Dallas Cowboys' loss is our gain. It was fun to sit down and get to know the man a little bit more who's been doing it the right way for over 25 years at KMOV. You don't win 6 Emmys ripping and reading.
Go to Overtime. Overtime with Oliver, with my dad. Tell your friends.
You don't do a lot of these. I appreciate it. How come you don't do a lot of them?
I guess I'm not asked to do very many. I guess they find me not interesting enough to not many people. You must be down on guests, or maybe you've already doubled through most years. But no, you know what? David, to be honest with you, I try to do as many as I can. I've done a few. I've made my living for 26 years in St. Louis, but 30 years asking people for their time as part of my job. And so when people, I've always tried, and particularly when I was the voice of the Rams and the Rams were rolling in the early 2000s, we were in demand. Now, Jack Snow never turned anybody down. He couldn't wait to talk to anybody. He had nothing else to do, as I told him all day long. I had jobs. But I've always tried to give my time back to people who ask, because I don't want to be a hypocrite, because I've asked people for their times for 3 decades.
We're doing this on a Sunday. What's a typical Sunday for you, Steve?
Little workout. Summertime is the pool. I love, I don't have a lot of vices, but I love to be in the pool. And then late Sunday afternoon, well, you know, we take the dogs to the park. Late Sunday afternoon, I'll go out and hit some balls. And if the course isn't crowded, I'll sneak out for 9 holes, usually until about sundown on Sunday night. And for the last 3 months, it's been watching Yellowstone during Master on Sunday nights. But the grand finale was last week, season finale. And my wife was just lamenting earlier today, we don't have Yellowstone to watch tonight. So I guess I'll watch an NHL playoff game.
What's your home course?
Oh, I don't really have one in particular. I play a lot of public golf, golf club at Wentzville, play there a lot. I'm at the Bluffs quite a bit. I'm at the Quarry at Crystal Springs. I played yesterday at a course I'd never played before, Incline Village in Forestell. I'll know a little bit more about how I should play it the next time I play. But I play all around. We played Peavey Farms last week. St. Louis is blessed with a lot of great public golf courses.
Whenever I wanted to feel good about my game, I'd go play 9 over at Baldwin.
Yeah, you know what? I think it's been – when I got back to town in the mid-90s, I played ball, and of course I would play 9 at Creve Coeur too. I go back to the days when Creve Coeur was 18 when I was growing up, and buddies of mine, and we were teens, and we would go play golf. We could go play 18 holes at Baldwin. We used to play at Cherry Creek. There's another course that's gone. But I've had some rounds of bowling.
Back in St. Louis, that means you grew up in St. Louis. What'd your mom and dad do?
Mom was a seamstress, worked really out of the house, never really got the chance to capitalize on her talents by having a business. My dad sold insurance, was an insurance broker for Crane Agency for 35 years in downtown St. Louis.
And you've got one brother?
I've got a brother, older brother and an older sister.
And what do they do?
My brother is down in Florida now. He was in television news. He's out of it now. He was a weatherman in Joplin. I was working actually in El Paso, Texas, and he came down and became the weatherman. So for 10 months in the early 90s at the CBS affiliate in El Paso, I was the sports director and he was the Monday through Friday weather guy, even though he didn't have a meteorological degree. But my sister is married to a former St. Louis County police officer, Jim McBride. He got in 30 years and then retired.
When you were in El Paso, was that when Stull was over at UTEP?
No, it was a couple years after that. It was okay. David Lee. When I arrived in July of 1990, Bob Stull was not only a household name, he was almost a god down there in El Paso with what he had done with the minors program.
So growing up in St. Louis, we eventually end up at Parkway North, but you went to grade school at Mason Ridge?
Mason Ridge for K through three, and then we moved after my parents got divorced. And then I ended up at Ross Elementary, went to Parkway North Junior High, and then Parkway North Senior.
You were a Wesco Viking.
Man, you've done your homework. Yeah, 7 years. I started playing football when I was seven. My dad won that argument. My mom thought it might be a little too dangerous. My friend up the street was going to start playing in Wesco, and my dad won out, and I'm glad he did because I started playing when I was seven. It was one of the best things I ever had. 7 years of junior football league gave me not only the basis for the game of football, but also taught me some things about life.
Were you big then too?
I was a bigger kid. I was, they had lights and heavies, and I was always the kid that was heavy. I was never a light in the rear end, and always a big kid growing up. I kind of stopped growing through 3 years of junior high, and then I shot back up like crazy my junior and senior year.
What do you remember about Parkway North?
Just what a great experience I had, how many great teachers I had. I'm still friends. I play golf with my high school buddies on a regular basis. My head football coach, Dennis Staub, we are still very, very close to this day. He taught me so much. He made my transition to college football easier than it might have been, and he taught me a lot about life. I love Coach to death. I had a great baseball coach in Bob Robin over there who in 1 year, I only had him for 1 year of varsity, unfortunately, but he taught me more baseball in 1 year than I'd learned the previous 11 years. So everything I have to say about my Parkway education and specifically Parkway North is I couldn't be happier before I went to high school.
So walk me through this. We've had Randy on the show before. So mm-hmm. out of Parkway North, you've got you, you've got Randy. Who else out of Parkway North later made a living in journalism?
John Kelly.
Okay.
And brother Dan and Andy Strickland.
Did you know any of those guys going up?
I did not. John was a few years older than me. And, you know, in those days, the high schools were separate from junior high. So you're only there in the building 10 through 12. And I didn't know Randy when I was in high school. Did not know.
So growing up at Parkway North, give me a little idea on where the Hawks were. I remember there was that Dunkin' Donuts as with Fifi and Olive.
Where the hangouts were?
Yeah.
Oh, there was a pizza place across from Westport. This was really junior high, I guess, more so. But Balducci's? No, that was Barnaby's. Balducci's is on Marine. Or Bennington, I'm sorry, in Bennington as you go to Marine. You know, we hung out at a lot of friends' houses and parties, and we played poker and in basements and those kinds of things. We didn't have one particular hangout, I would say.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Barnaby's. I was friends with the family that owned that Barnaby's.
Yeah.
And they were my favorite place to go sleep over because when you went to go sleep over, Barnaby's at night, Barnaby's in the morning.
Yeah, I remember it was good pizza. We thought it was. That was a big junior high hangout for sure.
So you went to Northwest Missouri State. What was your recruitment like before you ended up there?
Well, you know, there were some Mizzou asked me to walk on. I had, you know, I wasn't getting any scholarship offers from Division I schools. I was about 100, and through the recruiting process, I was about 190 pounds, 6'2", frame was growing. Recruited by some schools in the MIAA, the conference that Northwest plays in. I was kind of dead set on going to Missouri State. Back then, it was still Southwest Missouri State. They were moving out of the MIAA conference and going to Division I AA. That would be their first year. Thought I had a pretty solid deal in place. That was yanked out from underneath my feet the night before the signing date. I was a Pell Grant kid, too, so I didn't need a complete full ride in football. I knew I'd get financial aid, so I wanted to go. I wanted to play football where somebody wanted me, and money was tight. My parents didn't have any money to pay for my education. I wanted to make sure that my education was paid for, and I was going somewhere where they wanted me to play football. Ended up being Northwest, and it turned out to be a great place for me because, you know, when you go away and you're a 198-pound linebacker, I ended up starting my third game my freshman year. You don't tell people that you're going to a Division II school, even in 1982, at 198 pounds and say you're going to play in the NFL, but that was exactly my goal. And I knew that if I worked hard, I could make that goal come true. That's what I believed. And so Northwest was a great place for me.
What is it about the sport of football that attracts you?
You know, David, I grew up playing football and baseball. Started playing both in first grade, liked them both. Began playing basketball in fourth grade, although I would say basketball was probably my third best sport and the sport I was in that was least interested in. I liked it. But there was just something. I remember being 7 years old, and I remember the smell of Stick'Em on a Saturday afternoon, and playing at the old North Parkway North Junior High. That's where I was West Coast home field for 7 years. I remember the smell of crabgrass mixed with dirt, Stick'Em, eye black. And I remember just sitting back there, kid that could run, and they took advantage of it. I remember my very first game waiting for the opening kickoff, and I grabbed it and I went about 70 yards for a touchdown, and I was hooked. I was hooked the first time. Listen, I grew up with a brother who was 6 years older and a sister that was 4 years older, and I'm trying to keep up with those two and their friends, and I'm getting knocked around like crazy, playing football, hockey, roller hockey, baseball, whatever. So when I started playing with kids my own age, it wasn't a daunting task for me.
So were you Fed Biletnikoff or were you Hitman A's?
No, I was just, I was neither. I was, I played running back growing up and linebacker, been a linebacker. I was a linebacker since 7 years old. And I just loved the challenge of playing the game of football. It was just, and same thing with baseball. But baseball is one of those sports where, you know, you can wear the collar for the day. You can go 0-for-4 and leave some runners on base, and you got to wait 2 or 3 days or maybe a week for your next chance to redeem yourself. In football, you have a bad series, you can go right back out and do something about it. At least that's the way I looked at it.
So you're playing football. That's a huge time commitment. And if I got it right, you double major while doing all that.
Yeah, it wasn't a true double major, but maybe it was. I don't know. It was just my friends joke, my college buddies say that, you know, they were getting PE degrees and everything else. I had a semester of Shakespeare. I don't know why I would go through that. I had two semesters of Shakespeare and everything else, but English always came easy to me. I always felt more comfortable growing up writing something than telling people something, which is kind of ironic, the business I went into, but I always felt like I could write very well. And there were a lot of composition back then. That was the other downside to being an English major. But I also got my feet wet in journalism, both at Parkway North and at Northwest. At Parkway North, I was the editor-in-chief of the newspaper my senior year. And then I spent 3 semesters as the sports editor of the college newspaper, which is interesting because I got to write game stories, advanced stories, and a game wrap-up stories about the games that I was actually playing in. So it was kind of a unique experience.
Out of 10 people, how many told you, no, yeah, NFL, you got a shot?
Oh, I didn't talk much about it, to be honest with you. I don't know. If I had to put a number on it, if I had a conversation with 10 people, probably maybe a couple of my teammates would have believed it. My family would have believed it, but less than 50% for sure.
How'd you end up in Dallas?
I didn't get drafted. The draft was in 1 day back then. It started at 7:30 in the morning and ended at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was 12 rounds. It was a brutal day. I was projected to be anywhere in the this Post-Dispatch had it. I was projected to be anywhere from the fifth to the eighth round. I got phone calls from teams and nobody ever pulled the trigger. The Cowboys had actually sent a scout to my apartment and hoping that I wouldn't get drafted and wanted to sign me to a free agent contract. In fact, I became so frustrated by about 11 o'clock that night, I think they were in the 11th round, that I kindly asked him to leave and go to the local hotel. I went to bed. My agent called me when the draft was over and said, don't sign with Dallas right now. Tomorrow morning by noon, we'll have four, five, or six offers. And the next morning, my roommate wakes me up at 7 in the morning. And he says, the scout is back with orange juice, donuts, and a contract and a pen, and he wants your name on it. And so I called my agent. And he says, don't. Tell him to wait. And so we had several offers. And I just felt like the Cowboys had shown the most interest in me. At that time in the mid-'80s, they had had three-fourths of their starting secondary were free agents, Everson Walls, Michael Downs, and Bill Bates. I felt like they had a genuine program of bringing guys in who were free agents that they gave great looks to. And, you know, that was the team that I felt like I should sign with.
I'm sure you grew up a football Cardinal fan. How surreal was it the first time you looked over and you saw the hat?
Strange, very strange. Yeah, I grew up not liking Tom Landry. I grew up not liking George Allen. I was a Cardinal through and through, diehard. So one of the cool things about coming back to town, David, has been becoming friends with a lot of the guys who inspired me to want to play professional football. My friend Keith Wortman, getting to know Dan Dierdorf, becoming good friends with Jim Hannifin, Willard Harrell, Tim Carney, one of my all-time favorites, the guy that I loved because he was a Division II guy who made it in the NFL as a linebacker, and he emptied the bucket on every single down. In every single game. So to get to know these guys when I came back to town, the guys that inspired me to want to play professional football, that's been pretty cool.
You make the team. That'd be awesome.
No, I didn't make the team. First year I got cut. I got cut. This is how arduous the process was. I went to camp on July 6th. I got cut on August 30th or thereabouts, the last linebacker cut out the door. This was the days of 45-man rosters. There was no 53-man roster. There was no practice squad. So there's 18 extra spots that guys have now that we didn't back then. And out the door, as disappointing as I was in 1986, they said, we're going to re-sign you. We're going to re-sign you. We're going to move you to outside linebacker because we think there's more. We think you can play. And they encouraged me not to go back to school. I had about 8 hours left of my degree to get. And they said, we're going to move you down here in the off season, which they did. And they put me up in the March through July of 87. Went to camp again in 87 as an outside linebacker, and things were going great. And one play ended it. Ended up with a compression fracture in my neck, and the big problem was nerve damage to my right arm. My right arm was just dead for 3 months. Couldn't lift it, couldn't use it. But I have to say, the Dallas Cowboys did everything they were supposed to. They were fantastic. They took care of me. And at the end of 1987, they cut me loose and said, we don't think you should play football anymore.
When I hear neck injury, I just
So do I. I mean, so do I. I mean, in 33 years, when I see guys getting carted off and, you know, it brings back memories, I was strapped in, carted off in the OR. I had all my pads cut off. They unscrewed my face mask from my helmet to get it off. They weren't sure what they were dealing with at the time. And so it was an arduous two-a-day physical therapy, you know, regimen for about 2 to 3 months, and thought maybe they were going to activate me. In those days, you could have gotten activated off IR after 6 weeks, and I thought maybe I might in a late season game because we had some linebacker injuries, and they decided no. And I took physicals for other football teams in the spring of 1988, and they wouldn't pass me at that point and said, you know, you probably should just move on.
24 years old. Dream's dead. What do we do now?
Boy, you're reading my mind here. It's like you were there in 1988. Pretty devastated. Mom got tired of hearing me mope around. She understood how disappointed I was. She was disappointed for me. But, you know, she said, you know, you've spent all these years as a student getting yourself ready to make a living with your mind. If it didn't work out with your body, she said, go do it. But so I was very, very close to going to law enforcement. And I really wanted, I had my sights set on being a Missouri Highway Patrolman. My brother at the time had gone to Broadcast Center. He did not have a college degree, but he had gone to Broadcast Center. He was doing radio in Joplin, got the opportunity to go to work for the ABC affiliate in Joplin, Missouri, small market, and become the Monday through Friday weather guy. And I went down and visited him, and he was trying to talk me into going into TV news. And long story short, we're watching a 10 o'clock broadcast down there, and this might have been 1988. And the sports guy at the time gave the score backwards. He said the Royals got beat by the Brewers 2-4. Well, that was just, that's a mortal sin in my family, in my sports family. You know, you just don't say things like that. And you don't say things like that while you're making a living on television as a sportscaster. So we went back to my brother's office, and he said, did you hear that? I said, yeah, I heard it. He said, if you don't try to get in this business, I said, all due respect, I mean, you're in Joplin, Missouri. I'm not sure this is where, nothing against Joplin, but, you know, I'm not sure this is where I want to settle. He said, you don't have to. You know, this would just be a stepping stone. And so I went to Broadcast Center, and I became the first guy placed out of there in television news. Everybody else had, it was primarily at that time in the late 80s, a radio curriculum. And they had great success placing people in radio, like my brother. But I told him up front, I'm not interested. I'm going to be a sportscaster on TV. And so said, well, we'll help you get a tape together, but you'll probably have to find your own job. And I did in Billings, Montana.
Did you know Doug Huber?
I did very well. That was the owner of Broadcast Center. And he said, okay, we don't have a lot of experience with it, but we're going to give you the curriculum and the background you need to be, to sharpen whatever broadcast skills you have. And then we'll work with you to try to get a job. And I did, for the grand sum of $12,000 a year in November of 1989 in Billings, Montana, market 162.
You know, for people who don't know Broadcast Center and Doug Huber, what you just gotta love is how many dreams walk through that door. And at first blush, anybody but Doug would have been like, man, I'm not thinking, this is not good for you. But he would turn it around, and he'd get you taped, and he would tell you what you were doing wrong. And there were dozens and dozens of people who got jobs out of there that really, had they gone the conventional route, there's no way they would have ended up in broadcasting.
No, you're exactly right. And I think that they were very honest. They didn't want to just take people's money. And if they didn't think that, I know that there were times where they turned people away and says, I just don't think this is, we're right for you. But let me also give credit to a couple of old veteran hard scrabble radio guys who taught me and everybody else so much. Jack Warnick and Bob Sheehan, two of my instructors, and they're no longer with us, but they were fantastic to deal with. They were tough now. I mean, they didn't grade on a curve. They wanted you to get things right. They taught you how to read with pace, how to read with authority, how to read with comprehension. And then another guy, Doug Mazinski, kind of took me under his wing. David, I had to make a tape in the basement of Broadcast Center in the summer of 1989 with very little ventilation and air conditioning. And I'm a sweater. I mean, if you've seen Broadcast News and Albert Brooks, that's what I look like. In fact, my buddy still banged me about the broadcast we had during the eclipse in 2017. About I sweat through all my shirts and everything else. But it took about 50 takes for me to get something where I didn't look like a soaking wet mess. Dave Mazinski was the guy that kind of took me under his wing, taught me how to edit, which is what you need in your first job in television sports, taught me how to shoot a camera, taught me how to put makeup on my face, even though it was a disaster for the first 6 months I was working in Montana. But so I had a lot of good mentorship over at Broadcast Center, a really good experience.
Who taught you how to sit on the end of your coat?
You know, I think that was a guy named Chris Byers, my first sports director I worked for in Montana. I was the weekend sports guy, and then 3 days a week I was doing news reporting, which drove me insane in that market, because I was doing things like covering the Sugar Beet Symposium that was in town that week, and the curly top virus, which had wiped out, and then they're telling me to turn it into a 2.5 minute package. But Chris Byers taught me a lot in my first stop up there. He was a veteran guy. He's still there. He loves it. He could have gone on. Talented guy, but he raised his family in Montana, loved it up there. And he taught me how to sit on a coat. He also taught me that don't waste your words on a script when you can just write ad lib and we'll call for video.
You know, we've joked about Billings.
You beat out 74 or 75 people for the gig.
Man, you've done your I don't know where that would come up in your research, but I've brought that up before because if I go back and I show you my tape, you'd think, how in the hell did a news director, a general manager think that I was better than 74 other people? Okay. When I look at my tape that got me a job in Billings, Montana, I was stiff as a board. Okay. And I tell young people, I said, it's like anything else, more reps in golf, more reps in baseball, more swings, you're going to get better. But there were 74 other people that got turned down for that $12,000 a year job in Billings, Montana. And the funny thing, David, is because there's so much turnover, you know, in an entry level market like that, the general manager, first of all, I got on the phone with him when he offered me the job, and I said, well, can you fly me up to see it? And he laughed. He says, I'm paying you $12,000 a year. I said, we don't have that kind of thing, the budget. He says, you're welcome to come up. I said, no, it's okay. He said, you have to make me a promise that you'll give me a year here. I said, okay. Well, it's 6 months. I started looking, and I got flown into El Paso for a job interview, and I got the offer. And so this was only 8 months in, and I'm flying back to Billings thinking, how am I going to walk into Ron Olson's office and tell him when I promised him I'd give him a year that I'm taking off? So I called him up on a Monday morning. I said, when I come in today, can I see you? He said, sure. He stopped me when I started the conversation and said, let me guess, you got a job. I said, yep. He said, I anticipated this. Here's a letter of reference. You don't belong here. Go ahead.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I've had a lot of great people along the way in the first three stops where I got to St. Louis.
Here's my Montana story. I'm leaving St. Louis. I took the gig to be a director of sales manager for a couple all sports radio stations in Salt Lake City, right? It's the summer of Mark McGuire. So I'm driving to Salt Lake City on a Saturday. And for people who don't know, the exits on those highways when you're in that part of the country are like next exit 42 miles, next exit 70 miles. So yeah. I've got the game on the radio and I'm trying to time out McGuire's at bats as I'm getting near gas stations, right? So it'd be like, I'm at the Flying J for 20 minutes waiting for him to get an at bat. Then I get back in the car, they go down 1-2-3, 1-2-3. I got to go like 105 to get to the next gas station. Were you ever caught in a big snowstorm in that place?
Oh, yeah, actually, 100%, yes. Well, first of all, on my drive up there, I drove to Denver the first night. And then the second night, going Denver through Wyoming. When I got to northern Wyoming around, the last 50 miles before I get to the Montana line, I experienced what they call a ground blizzard, where the snow was just swirling about 3 feet off the ground and nothing at the windshield level. And it was just weird. I got turned on the radio and they were calling it a ground blizzard. There were a lot of long, cold nights. At 30 below at night. The high would be 15 below in the winter. And then the Chinook winds would blow out of Alberta and it would go to 40 above, 50 above, and then it'd go back down to 30 below. Everybody plugged their car in. I had a little truck. I did not have a block heater, and it never failed me, fortunately. But if you worked in Salt Lake City in radio, it must have been for Bonneville, right?
Actually, Bonneville owned KSL. My group was Citadel Communications.
Okay.
And so the year before I got there, they got the Jazz away from KSL. It was one of those broker deals where we're not going to pay any money, but we'll give you all the inventory. And so I got there the year after Russell lost his shoes to Jordan. And they were in the finals the next year. And Salt Lake City was beautiful. I mean, it was just that whole part of – in fact, our owner, Larry Wilson, he had a ranch in Wyoming. And we would fly in. It was private airport and just see gorgeous country as far as the eye could see. He was a billionaire, but that's my – you got my two Montana stories, Steve. That's all I got.
Well, Bonneville was the – Bonneville owned 101 ESPN. So I worked for Bonneville for the first 4 years or so that 101 had the Rams broadcast. So, I've known KSL had a – KSL TV, I'm sure the radio station was the same, but KSL TV had a phenomenal reputation. I mean, the money flowed. It was a beautiful operation. When I was in El Paso, we would go to – I was in Salt Lake City to cover a WAC tournament, basketball tournament, and also a regional, which UTEP was sent there. And I got to work out of, because they were CBS at the time, and I got to work out of KSL, and I thought, wow, if I ever get to a station like this, I will have made it.
So this is before PC. I didn't get into television. I went to Mizzou, did a journalism thing, went straight into radio. I was an anchor at KOMU, the NBC affiliate where all the news guys, and you kind of cut your teeth. Again, before PC, you don't look enough like the old anchor. You look too much like the new anchor. Anybody ever tell you, and I hope nobody did, but that you were too big for TV?
Yeah, I had a couple of times people would tell me you're too Tank McNamara-ish. That, if anybody's familiar with the cartoon, Tank McNamara.
He was Mr. Incredible before there was Mr. Incredible.
Well, yeah, and I'm not saying anybody thought I was Mr. Incredible, but, you know, I was a bigger guy. Back then I was lifting a lot of weights. I was powerlifting, and I had come off a football field and everything else. And so, you know, one man's trash in our business is everything is so subjective that one man's trash is another man's treasure. When I was working in Hartford, Connecticut, we were owned by Viacom. That's how I got to St. Louis. The station, KMOV and WVIT at the time in 1994, were owned by Viacom. But the president of Viacom, as he kind of interceded to make sure I got to St. Louis, because we were in a kind of a contract dispute when I was coming here, but he said to me, you'll do well because you're cosmetically acceptable. I think that's the best compliment I ever got about, that's as far as anybody ever went with me about my looks, is that you're cosmetically acceptable. So I'll never forget that day in May of 1994 when he told me that.
You're in Hartford. Ever interview at ESPN?
No, I did not. We had a lot of people leave behind the scenes, a lot of production assistants, people that would eventually go on to become producers. I think maybe I sent a tape there at the 6-month mark. It just didn't seem like, and of course, nobody really lives in Bristol who worked at ESPN. I've been to Bristol. It didn't wow me. Hartford felt to me from the moment I got there like it was going to be a stepping stone. I did have my news director at the 6-month mark ask me if I had interest in becoming his main news anchor, at least auditioning for him. And I thought that came out of left field. And it was 1993. I was going to conquer the world in sports. And so I was still pretty idealistic, and I turned him down. But that was always in the back of my mind until I got the opportunity to start doing it in 2007.
In Connecticut, at least you're closer to your Boston Celtics.
Yes. In fact, one night I was going to interview with Larry Bird. It was after Bird had retired. And in those days, the Celtics would play 2 or 3 games a year in Hartford at the Civic Center. And I was scheduled to go live with Larry Bird. It got canceled on me at the last moment. But, you know, Hartford was an interesting market. It split right in the middle of Connecticut. And Hartford and South in Connecticut are all New York fans. And then Hartford and North, like towards Springfield, Massachusetts, and the northern part of Connecticut, they're all Boston. They identify as Boston fans. And so the 11 o'clock sports, and we did a 10 o'clock cable show, it was fast and furious. In baseball season, you'd have the Mets, you'd have the Yankees, you'd have the Red Sox. In hockey season, you'd have the Rangers, the Islanders, the Devils, the Bruins to get to in basketball season. So, I mean, it was really a lot of fun for me cramming. It felt like every night I was cramming 20 pounds into a 10-pound bag. But if you're doing sports locally on TV, that's what you want. You know, the 5 and 6 o'clock sportscasts are always kind of boring because it's a preview or you're talking to somebody, you got a soundbite or a recap. The 10 o'clock is what you like because, you know, you're showing highlights.
I'm going to date ourselves, Steve. How much time did the sports get back in the day?
A lot more. I mean, it depends. What you, I mean, I had on the weekends in Billings, Montana, I had 7.5, 8 minutes on Saturdays and Sundays, more than I wanted. In El Paso was probably similar, probably about 4 minutes, 5 minutes a night. Hartford was probably 3.5 to 4 minutes. Maybe 5 on some nights on the weekends. And, you know, as you know, it's been whittled down dramatically just about anywhere you go since then.
1994, you get back to St. Louis at KMOV. Had you been sending tapes to St. Louis trying to come back, or was this really the first good chance?
No, I had an opportunity it came out of the blue about going to Dallas when I was in Hartford, and I was excited about that. And I had an agent at the time that, it's my only experience with an agent. It did not go well. He was so abrasive that the news director in Dallas just decided, I'm not even going to try to negotiate this deal. Mm. And so how I got to St. Louis was really almost by accident. They were looking for someone to succeed Zip here, and they were dead set on sending I worked with Beasley Reese in Hartford. He was the sports director. He played for the Giants for 10 years, was doing a lot of NBC work, and he'd be gone on the weekends, and I got all the reps I wanted. It was really a great situation, and Beasley was a great mentor to me. He always jokes that I went to BU, Beasley University, and the idea was to send him here to St. Louis, and then I was going to take over as sports director in Connecticut. But Beasley and the general manager, Alan Cohen, for whatever reason, they just didn't hit it off. And Beasley came back into Hartford and he said, that's not going to work. He said, I think they're going to try to send you down there. Well, I interviewed in April of 94. I'm in the lobby of KMOV and waiting for Alan Cohen to come down from the general manager's office and Steve Hamill, the news director, to come out. And I'm looking across the street at the time. That was the Adams Mark Hotel right across the street from KMOV. And Alan Cohen came down and said, that's the Adams Mark. I said, I know, my dad sold insurance in that building for decades. It was the Pierce building. And he looked at me like, you're from St. Louis? I said, you don't know I'm from St. Louis? And we went to Balaban's in the Central West End, had a great meal. We hit it off, and I ended up coming here.
You know, Guy Phillips has a similar situation, story, where he was replacing somebody in a market because that guy was going to St. Louis. They went to St. Louis. It was horrible. Those guys were back within like 2 months, and Phillips just pulled up and replaced the guy in St. Louis, and that's how he ended up in St. Louis.
Well, I'd say it worked out pretty well for Guy Phillips and also for St. Louis radio.
Had you worked at a CBS affiliate before? Because I know folks, and they tell me what it's like to work at a CBS affiliate during March Madness is unlike working anywhere else. Would you agree? Do you have a story on that?
Well, I would agree. I worked for in El Paso. It was a CBS affiliate. I was NBC in Billings, and I was NBC in Hartford, but CBS in El Paso. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of late hours, but it's beyond just March Madness. CBS is one of those, on Sunday nights, they've never condensed network programming. It doesn't matter how late the NFL goes. It doesn't matter how late March Madness goes. NBC over the years, a lot has condensed Sunday night programming. But, you know, CBS has the showcase show, 60 Minutes. And so there are a lot of nights, Sports Sunday, when it was an hour at KMOV, when we wouldn't go on the air until sometimes 11:40, get off the air at 12:40. That was just part of working for a CBS affiliate. They did not condense their primetime programming on Sunday night. I think now they do a little bit. If they go past a certain point with the NFL, they will. But back in the day, no. So, yeah, a lot of late nights, Sunday nights in particular, working for CBS affiliate.
How cool was it to be on in front of your folks?
David, that is really, I tell people all the time, that's the fringe benefit I had no idea about. That is, both parents are gone now. I lost my mom in 16. I lost my dad in 06. But the one thing I could never put a value on, and I didn't have any idea when I came back to St. Louis what a big deal it would be for them, was for my parents to be able to turn on the TV and watch their kid, whether he was in the sports chair or the news anchor chair 5 nights a week, or to sit and listen to their kid call an NFL game, you know, in the hometown for 16 years. My wife, before she would take off and head to the dome, would set my father lived with me and would live with us for the last 10 years of his life. She would set him up on the couch with the TV up, the volume down, and the radio turned up. And it was a big deal for both my parents. David, that's a great question, because I say it all the time, that is the fringe benefit I had no idea about. And it meant a lot to both my parents.
Did you get to do a live spot from Parkway North?
Did I do a live spot? Yeah, I think I broadcast. When I first came back to town, I did a lot. I did some high school football live shots. You know, I'm a football junkie. My good friend, my college teammate, was coaching for Don Greco over at Pattonville High School, Pete Barrett. And so, you know, I just I've always loved the Suburban North Conference back in the 90s. These kids just got after each other in a way that just didn't look like the rest of high school football in St. Louis. I mean, it was more like a college football game. So I did a lot from there. I did some live shots. I think I did a couple of live shots on a Friday night from Parkway North. I didn't want to be too much of a homer and make it too obvious and be stationed at 1268 Fifi, 1268 or 8260 Fifi Road every Friday. I thought that would be a little much, but I think I did do a couple of live shots over there.
You know, you get to call your own number, man. You're in charge.
You do, yeah. But you don't want to wear. You don't want to be too transparent about certain things.
So the cool part is you get to be in front of your folks. Bad part, maybe you're in front of friends or people who knew you growing up. You're walking through Deerberg's. You made a small little mistake the night before. They want to remind you about it. Was there pressure on a bad side about being back in town?
I would say that people know you best can sometimes they're the ones that will tell you what the bad stuff or what people are saying, or you screwed this up, or you screwed that up. But you know, that's part of it. I tell people all the time that 99% of the people that talk to you in public and encounter you are very nice and are very well-intentioned. And if you can't deal with that percentage, when you do have somebody who is rude, then you shouldn't be in the business. And I think most people that don't watch you or don't have an affinity for you or don't like you, look, one of the things you learn in this business, I don't have to tell you this, you understand this, some people are going to like you and some people are not going to like you. And you're not going to change. You're probably not going to change either one. But, you know, you deal with what you have to deal with. And the funny thing is that I was in St. Louis for 18 years before I made this full-time switch to news. But I was doing news and sports for 5 years, from 07 to the end of 12. There were weeks when Larry Connors was on vacation when I would fill in at 5, 6, and 10 on the news and also produce and anchor the sports in the same broadcast. But you'd be surprised, for 18 years, there are a lot of places I could go, and it was hit and miss about people knowing you or not. But, you know, the exposure you get when you become the news anchor and you're on much more often, and there are people that don't watch sports, it really changed in early 2013. More and more people, it became obvious that more and more people knew who you were. But that's not a bad thing. If I've been in St. Louis 26 years and I'm completely anonymous, something's not right. You know, whether you like me or not, somebody's got to know who I am after 26 years.
How did the Rams opportunity come up?
I had joined the broadcast in 98. Steve Schlanger and I were doing pregame. We were doing halftime, and I would fill in on some sideline reporting. Did that in 98, did it in 99. I also had the good fortune of hosting the Dick Vermeil Show on Monday nights for two years. I did not apply, and when Gary Bender left in 98, I thought that my friend Steve Schlanger had the inside track, and I did not want to, I just felt like, you know, he was going to get it and deserved it, and I was happy for my friend. Mike Bush ended up with it. Listen, Mike and I get along great. We're respectful. People said, how was it? You're in the booth. And, you know, when I was done with pregame, I got out. It was Mike's booth. At halftime, I came in, and then I got out. It was Mike's booth for that year. And I think Mike did a credible job. In fact, I think his Super Bowl call was very, very good. I mean that sincerely. For whatever reason, Mike stepped away. And the folks at 103.3, Rick Weinkauf and Mike Wheeler had become the program director. And they said, you didn't apply last time. We want you to apply this time. So I went through the application process. Mike Wheeler had watched me on the broadcast for the 99 season. He had watched my work on television. He had watched me every night work with Dick Vermeil on the Coach to Show. He knew I knew the game. He was convinced I could do the job. So was I, David. You know who wasn't convinced? John Shaw, president of the Rams. And I never took it personally, but Mike Wheeler, Wheels as I call him, let me know every step of the way. It was like, as he said, it was like pushing a boulder uphill for 4 straight months to get me that job. Because John believed that for whatever reason, Mike stepped away after a year. He thought if I did this job and it didn't work out and it's one and done, then he thought, well, maybe we're going to start alienating all these TV stations. We're still fairly new in St. Louis. He was making a business decision. He favored somebody with a bigger resume coming from California. Mike Wheeler said, we're paying the $1 million, which I guess was the franchise fee back then or whatever it was. This guy knows the game. He played the game. He works his butt off. He'll do the job. Finally, in mid-May, he called me and said, it's yours. But John Shaw told me not to talk to him for a very long time because he's very angry at me. Well, John and I are just fine. I never took it personally, and I think John understood that he made the right decision. Hopefully he did, and it worked out well for 16 years. But it was a business decision, and I always tell Mike Wheeler, who's now a program director in Detroit with a cluster of stations that have the Lions broadcast. I always tell him I wouldn't have had the job without that. Now, Mike's pretty modest about it, but every once in a while, you need somebody in your corner, and I was determined for 16 years never to let Mike down. He went to bat for me.
Did you get a ring?
Did not, David. And I tell you what, I didn't really want a ring. I'm the guy that – I'm old school, and this is why Jack Snow, even though we were separated by 20 years, were such great friends. We were so alike in how we thought about things. I would never wear that ring. As a broadcaster, you don't make a tackle. You don't kick a field goal. People feel differently. I got something that I treasure even more out of it. They did not give the broadcast team rings. Jack Snow obviously got one. But when we went to training camp the next year, the first day we were at training camp, Bob Wallace, who was vice president and general counsel, brought us over and he presented each of us with a replica of Lombardi trophy that all the players had. And they engraved our name on it. And it sits in my office today. And that means more to me than having a ring, because I wouldn't wear it. But every once in a while, I get to look and see, go back and see what a great season that 99 season was by looking at the trophy. And it was just a class thing for the Rams to do.
So what's more prominently displayed, the six Emmys or the football trophy?
That's not even close, David. The six Emmys are in a box. And for those who know me, I haven't entered anything in the Emmys for years. When it's not that I don't think – look, if you win a regional Murrow or DuPont Award, brother, that's legitimate. I'm not saying Emmys aren't legitimate, but when you've been part of the process by which you judge Emmys, sometimes it taints how you look at the award. I haven't entered anything in a while. I am entering a couple of spotlight stories that I've done, spotlight on those who served, honoring our veterans from this year, only because I want my editor, Krista Ulberg, who is so phenomenal. I mean, I think I tell a pretty good story. She has turned some good stories into awesome stories with her editing. I want her to win a couple of Emmys, and so that's why I entered this year. And I've never been to an Emmys award. Nothing wrong with it. I don't begrudge anybody who wants to go. I won't go this year, but God, I'm hoping that Krista Ulberg wins two Emmys because she deserves it.
Is writing for TV a lost art?
Yes. Did I answer, maybe I should have hesitated for a second or two.
So we had Art Holliday on, right? And he totally gives Ron Jacober props for conciseness and arc and things of that nature. You talked about your editor and wanting to get props, but there's a lot of writing that goes into those things as well. And it sounds to me like that's something, no offense, man, but it sounds like it hit your radar.
Well, it did. Every generation of broadcaster complains about, I mean, I came in, Julius and Larry, and Julius to this day is a very good friend, and we chat via email a couple times a week. But I think one of the things, David, that's missing are the commensurate stops along the way before you get to a top 20 market. And I think it's opened things up. I'm not one of these guys that says, well, you can't be here if you're 25 years old. No, wrong. I'll tell you who proved that was Courtney Bryant. She was 24 when we interviewed her from Bakersfield, California. We could all see that she would come in and do the job. But the downside was, and I told the news director at the time, she's only going to be here for one contract. Okay. And that's pretty much what it was, 4 years. So I don't believe you shut people off and say they don't get considered because they're a certain age or have been anywhere. But when you do make stops, I mentioned Chris Byers, my mentor in Montana. In El Paso, it was Bob Mitzberg. And I had a great news director, Joyce Reed, who was tough as nails, but she taught me a lot of things. In Hartford, it was Beasley Reese. And I worked for a tough news director there who taught me things, Steve Schwade. And then I get to St. Louis, and I have Steve Hamill as a news director, who I love to this day. I love him to run through a brick wall for. I think when you make those stops along the way, you have people that influence you and lead you with some things. And I think some of that is missing today in writing for broadcast. And the other thing that mystifies me sometimes is we can sit in consultant meetings and go over things for an hour or two at a time, and then 2 weeks later, we're back to doing the same old stuff. I just grew up in an era where you get told things once, and then you make changes. I'm not saying I know everything there is to know about writing, but I think you have to make a concerted effort to review your work. I grew up in football. You never drew conclusions about how you played until Monday when you watched film. I called 330 or 340 NFL games, including preseason. I listened to every single one of them. I had to deal with the producer. They would make me three discs, the three-hour broadcast. They would hand it to me on Monday. And then throughout that week, going back and forth to work, I would listen to the game. I listened to more than 300 games. That's how you learn. That's how you – I still look at air checks. 30 years into the business, I record every broadcast I do, and I look critically to see what I did right, what I didn't do right. And so I just think self-evaluation is a big part of it, and I think some of that's missing.
I knew more than a few sports guys whose ultimate goal was to get into news. Did you have the ultimate goal of getting into news?
No. I mentioned in 93, I was kind of 3 years in the business, and I had a news director that believed that was my ultimate goal. That's where I should be. And I always wondered in the back of my mind. And then really, David, I had a great sports department managing of six guys, Doug Vaughn and myself. We had a number of great third sportscasters. It was Tim McKernan, Ann Carroll. We had Bob West, Todd Schumacher, Jeff Skiversky. I had two great editors, and I had a great editor in Mark Griffin, and two great producers in Troy Roberts and Tim Cousarts. And about 08, when the economy tanks and the business starts tanking, where was the first place that TV station, local TV stations went? To the sports department. And we went from six people to two. So, I went from a six-man department to just Doug Vaughn and myself. And so I kind of saw the writing on the wall, and I'd always wondered whether or not I went to Alan Cohen and said, hey, can I fill in on the weekends? He goes, I can do better than that. You'll start filling in when Larry's gone. And Alan supported me in so many ways as my general manager for 18 years. I'm so grateful to have worked with him for 18 years. But so I had an interest in going to, and there were times, David, I'm not, I played ball at a Division II school. It's kind of a blessing because I'm not the kind of guy that stands on the side of the train station and watches the train pull out without me on it. And I'm very happy about it. That year redshirting somewhere, I got to step in and start. And I think it kind of accelerated my development, at least at the Division II level. In the same way in broadcasting, the Pope came to town in 99, and for 3 days, we didn't do sports. So we had a sports department, six guys. We were dusting off shelves, and we were reorganizing the sports department. We sat there, and I just felt like at some point, I'd really like to be involved in a day like this when we had tornadoes or terrible weather, and we were on the air live. Sports is canceled. I understand it. It makes perfect sense. Don't go on with something as trivial as sports when life and death is at stake. But I wanted to be part of it. And so I think that was the other part of it that made me want to make this switch.
You mentioned Julius Hunter. For whatever reason, he's not as well known and or thought of as he should be for a whole bunch of reasons. Let's do 45 seconds on Julius Hunter.
Incredible newsman, incredible judgment, a little bit cantankerous. That era, there was people watch Ron, Anchorman and Ron Burgundy. There's a little bit of truth. I like to give it to my friend Julius every once in a while. He had a little bit of Ron Burgundy in him. But I said, great judgment, a fantastic writer. He's authored 10, 15 books. Old school journalist. But here's the other thing, David. He paved the way for African-American anchors in this town. He was the first primary weeknight African-American anchor. And he's never complained about it, doesn't talk much about it. But I know for a fact he put up with a lot of pushback. And he heard a lot of things that a grown man should not have to hear. He pushed through it. And in my mind, he's a legend. And it was kind of surreal. You talk about a surreal moment. First night I sat down. And Larry, too. Look, Larry Conner's 30 years here. He got hired by KTVI from Channel 4, then got hired back by Channel 4. That just doesn't happen very often. So sitting next to those two guys when I first came back to town in May of 94, and, of course, I gave them the old, I've been watching you since I was in, kindergarten, whatever, and now it comes back on me. I'm getting the same thing when I go to the grocery store. Somebody checking me out at the checkout aisle, she says, I've been watching you since second grade. So it comes full circle.
So as we get ready to wrap this up, head towards the St. Louis 7. I want to thank Steve again for his time. A couple quick questions. Where did we meet Jennifer?
At World Gym in Chesterfield, Missouri. Shortly after I got home, in summer of 1994.
I love a good proposal story. Do you have a good proposal story?
I don't think mine's. I did a Christmas Eve dinner at her parents' house. It was a tradition at her mother and stepfather's house, and I told them I was going to do it. And then I think I acted, faked it like I had lost the ring. I opened the box and it was empty. And I think I had her grandmother throw it over me. Her grandmother, Ira Dean, she was a pistol, and I was fortunate to have her in my corner. But it wasn't, I don't think it was an all-timer, as my dad would say, no, but I tried to go to a little bit of effort.
Who was the coolest person you ever did get to interview?
Oh, I don't know. Coolest person to interview. You know, I tend to really, really, really like people who have gained notoriety, fame, celebrity, and they handle it really well. In the business, Bob Costas is as classy as I've ever met. Jack Buck was unbelievable with the rest of us in the media. In fact, when I got the job in the summer of 2000, the Rams job, he came out of the booth after the second inning and was taking a break. Mike was calling the game. And he said, come on, let's sit down. I want to talk to you about it. You want some advice? And I said, man, I'll soak up everything. And I did. And he was another man who handled his celebrity great. And in sports world, you know, I think maybe the all-time patient guy relative to how much was asked of him in St. Louis was Kurt Warner. I've never seen him turn anybody down. But you know, in those days, the Rams were full of guys with high character, including my friend DeMarco Farr. He was one of my favorite interviews, and then we became partners for 7 years. So I tend to think of, I lump a bunch of people together who've handled their fame well and are very humble to talk to.
Ever seen the movie Unbroken?
My favorite. Well, let me just say this. You're talking about the story of Louis Zamperini.
Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite book I've ever read. My wife gave it to me in a football season. I started reading it on the bus from Rams Park to the airport, read it on the flight to the West Coast. Didn't go to dinner with the boys that night because I couldn't put the book down. Finished it at 3:00 in the morning. If anybody's never read it, if you want to know a true American hero, you want to talk about overcoming and perseverance, Louis Zamperini. This man had more setbacks in his life and had more to deal with. And he ended up in the final 40 years of his life having the greatest attitude ever. I didn't like the movie, to be honest with you, David. I didn't think I was excited to see it. But it's one of those things where I don't think any movie would have, for me, would have matched the book. I'm so over the top about that book. I read it 3 times. I recommend it to anybody.
Title of the book again is?
Unbroken.
All right. So wrapping it up, wanted to make sure we talked a little bit, or as much as you want. You're on the board of directors for the Greater St. Louis Honor Flight, and I don't know as much about that as I should. Educate me.
I didn't either until 2016. My boss at the time, news director, knew that I had this great affinity for veterans, and particularly of the greatest generation. And Greater St. Louis Honor Flight had called the station and said, we have an opportunity for a reporter and photographer to go, and they're looking for publicity. He called me, he said, you want to do it? You have to get up at 3 a.m. I said, what do I care? I mean, some of these men lived through the Chosen Reservoir at -36 below for 3 weeks. They served 4 years, you know, they served a year in Vietnam. So I went, it was an incredible experience. I'd heard of the Honor Flight, didn't understand really what it did. The folks at Honor Flight took a liking to me for whatever reason. They liked the 2 stories I did. They invited me to MC their gala in September that year. I did it. And then a few months later, Rich Ledbetter and Rolando Lopez had come and recruited me. They came and recruited me to join the board of directors. And I was honored, and I've been on the board now for coming up on 4 years. And it's an incredible experience. And every veteran, if anybody's listening to this and you're a veteran, don't think because you didn't see combat that you're not worthy to go on. We have that a lot. Don't think that just because you don't have some crazy, wild combat story to tell, you didn't leave body parts somewhere, that you're not worthy to be on an Honor Flight. You are. Any man or woman who puts country first in uniform deserves to have the day that Greater St. Louis Honor Flight and other chapters give for them every day, every year. So We take 10 trips a year, 22 veterans each trip. We've made a great concerted effort to make sure we get World War II veterans taken care of, Korea. Now we're transitioning to the all-important Vietnam veteran. And it's just an incredible experience.
Steve, you're a busy guy. The podcast is called Overtime with Oliver, but really what we're trying to do is document St. Louis, document important people, places, and events in St. Louis. Hard to do if you don't have an episode with Steve Savard. So I appreciate your time, and I hope you had a good time.
I did, and you did your homework, man. It was great. Sometimes you were like not just asking relevant questions. You understood where my mindset was on a lot of different topics, and that's impressive. And I appreciate all the preparation. I'm a preparation guy, and you did a wonderful job. Thank you.
All right, off to St. Louis 7. Appreciate you, man.
Okay, man.
And another one for the books. Looking forward to seeing you on Monday, Patrick Murphy. Probably know him as voice of Channel 9, award-winning documentarian, most about St. Louis, and author of a new upcoming book, Candymen, the story of Switzer's licorice. We had fun. It was a good time. It's going to go up on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend. Thanks for all the recommendations and reviews. And as we do, thanks for your time this time. Till next time, so long.